it's authentic in concept, in delivery, and it tastes how it should taste, and it evokes a sensory response, then that's it for me, really, I think.
Welcome back, everyone, to the podcast that highlights the brilliant Birmingham food scene, Breaking Bread. I'm your host, Liam. Sitting opposite me is my brother from another mother, Carl McCaffrey.
All right.
How you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you?
I'd be better if we didn't have to do this again.
I know. We've just recorded this intro. Now we've got to didn't it play.
Oh, well, it's one of them things. At least it wasn't a whole episode. We haven't done the episode for a while where we've not recorded and then got to the end and went,
Yeah. But it's fine. We're here.
We're very good. Feeling Christmassy.
Yeah, man. Christmas is Christmas now. You're allowed to celebrate Christmas as soon as it hits December.
1st of December. Get the tree. Get the lights. I'm happy. Don't talk to me about midnight. Have you seen that video of the Scottish fella going mad?
No.
He's like, we're just after Halloween. Don't even talk to me about Christmas. She's got the deck and he's like walking out. He's like, I can't go. Yeah, that's me, that is.
Our tree's going up today.
Yeah, I've got to go down to Woods Farm tomorrow. Not an advert. I wish they would sponsor me and give me a free tree every year.
I know, man. They're expensive Christmas trees.
Christmas trees are dear. Now I'm right in the mood. I went up to the German market yesterday, as much as we despise the German market. But I love the independent market up at the St. Paul's.
Pigeon Park. Don't worry about it. But yeah, Pigeon Park, man, for the Independent Festival one.
That was way better.
That's what it should be. That should just, well, I'm not getting, every year I go into this rant, so I'm not getting into it again, but it should just be that one, but
yeah,
bigger.
Yeah, that was fantastic. We had a great time. Loads of great independent traders there. Chatty Patty. Although we'd already ate, we went to Corner Shop.
Yeah, man, you went to Corner Shop.
At Kilda.
Kilda, every Wednesday OPM. And Saturday.
Brilliant, man. Absolutely.
Such a good idea. Different pizza. Yeah. So delicious.
Oh, I had the pepperoni with it's got like a chili honey on it. I don't know if it had that when we went to the soft launch, but that was just so good.
Yeah,
and the corners are still ridiculous.
So it's like proper Detroit style, big, deep, big. Heavy. Like a slice is heavy. You pick it up, you're like, man, this has got some weight to it.
Yeah, crispy edge to it, ketchup kind of style middle to it, loaded with sauce and cheese, mozzarella, different mozzarella than I've ever had. It was unreal.
So good.
Yeah, loved it. And then the garlic bread to go with it with the bechamel sauce. That was banging as well.
Yeah, that's a great idea, that is.
Yeah, love it. Absolutely love it. I said before, you know, we were lacking pizza so bad just when we started this podcast. And then Polly came along. We had Otto. Oh, Smoke and Ash. Great pizzas. And now we've started branching out into doing like Detroit. Hopefully we'll get a Chicago style.
Yeah, Chicago will be next. Someone listening if you want to start doing a Chicago one as well.
Yeah, we'll be there for that as well. Loved it, man. It's just really good concept. I'm glad we're getting around to doing something cool.
That's it, man. Yeah, I love that place. They've done a great job with that.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's just a good bar as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I was there the other week. I went in before, I went to the English Whiskey Festival there and we popped into Kilda just like on the walk down from, well, we went to Bonehead obviously first. And then on the walk down, like you pretty much, well, I made it so we walked past Kilda. Because just as a bar alone, it's like, it's a cracking bar.
Mm. Yeah, it's good.
It's a nice place. It's cool. It's under the arches. Great beer, like incredible beer selection. One of the best beer selections going, I think.
The music there was wicked. It was like they robbed my iPod from when I was 17. Had all the classics on there. New metal for days. It was brilliant. Just a great place.
Yeah, when I was in there was some like, not Morris dancing, but like, just some people turned up, like these swords that are like got handles on both ends, and we're doing some dancing, like cleared the tables, and there was different groups doing it.
Yeah.
And I was like, my old man was like, did you know this was on? Like, is this why we're here? And I was like, I had no idea this was going on. Like, just randomly doing it. Like,
cool shit like that can only happen in Digbeth flat.
And it's only cool if you had no idea it's going to happen.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. If it was organized, you'd be like, what the hell is this?
But yeah, it was wicked.
Wicked. But yeah, that was the Whiskey Festival.
Yeah, that was good, man. Really good.
English Whiskey Festival. So just English whiskey.
Yeah, just English whiskey companies. And like, English whiskey doesn't really get much press, but there is some really, really good whiskey.
It's kind of overshadowed by Ireland and Scotland.
Scotland, definitely, I think. Scotland's just got it nailed, haven't they? There's like no one's beating proper Scottish whiskey. No, not even the English ones, to be honest, but there's some really good ones. Like once you're making it, you're making it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But like a lot of them, they get their barrels. Like I love the peaty whiskies. Mm. So they're all getting their barrels from Scotland, basically, to smoke them in.
Yeah. I think it's the water, though, isn't it? The water has an effect on it.
Yeah, I think they'll make everything. I ain't getting into the whole, like, had to make whiskey, but Jesus.
So there was any locals there? Or?
Spirit of Birmingham were there. I'm not sure. I can't remember if their whiskey's ready yet, but they had a rum on that they've got at the moment.
Nice. Did they like to sling the rum, or was it?
It's incredible. Yeah. Oh, mate, you can get loads of stuff. I was drinking brandy at one place. Like, that probably didn't help me. I was like, because I love brandy. Like, I was all over that. Yeah. Like, I always end up very, very drunk. But it's not just because, like, I drink before and I usually go out after. So, like, I have been told I can't go next year, which is very unlike my wife because she's very, like, easygoing and you do what you want, love, don't worry about it.
You can go to the festival and be sensible and have, like, just a nice little taste of everything. You don't have to go and, like, get smashed.
But that's, it's more the going out after that's the problem.
Yeah, not the festival.
Well, you need a couple of drinks to warm up because you can't just go straight onto whiskey. So you need a couple of beers first. And then once you've had, like, whiskey's bad because it makes you want to carry on drinking. Like, if I have a load of whiskey, then I'm like, right, I'm going to carry on.
No, whiskey makes me want to cry. Well, it used to.
Yeah, and when we end up going the Ruin and then getting a taxi was a nightmare from there. So it was like, right, we'll go up the Rainbow for a couple as well. Then we got back into Shirley and I was like, right, I'm popping the Shaking Hand. Does anyone want to come with me? Ended up in the Shaking Hand and then went last week into the Shaking Hand where they presented me with the bill that I didn't pay when I was in there.
Just walked straight out, didn't bother paying.
You know what? I'm that used to having a tab there that I don't know what happened. I must have just thought I paid. Which they're fine about. I think there's not many regulars in there that haven't done that at some point.
Sounds like a good day. Well, I'm glad the festival comes to Birmingham, right? It's a cool thing to have in Birmingham.
Yeah.
The more cool things that come to Birmingham, the better.
Again, that was at the Bond, and we were at the Bond the week before as well.
Yeah, independent festival, highlight of the year, every year without fail. Love it.
It was a bit of a different vibe because you're not sitting out in the sun.
Yeah, they've done such a good job of doing up that Bond. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is a great place. And the festival, like, oh, we had some great food, man.
So many traders. You like the old boys in the pub with the newspapers checking out all the horses. You're checking Insta to see all the lineup. What are you going to eat? Where are you going to eat?
Yeah, I knew where I was going and what I was having before I got there.
I love the crumpets from Whale & Jar. They were unbelievable.
They look good. Yeah, they did
fried
look good.
Chicken crumpets, man. Can't go.
Ala Mexicana were there slinging their tacos. They were good.
Yeah, wicked. I love Ala Mexicana.
You know what?
Coffee from Paws, obviously.
Yeah,
cake from
that
Paws.
Was it, man.
And then the markets, like having the market inside where all the dining areas instead of in a separate building. It created like a real nice market hall vibe. You know, Pips was there.
Yeah, Pips, Punk and Chances, like Becky's Brownies were there. Loads of like brownies and sweets and sake
wicked.
Company were there. Like,
Yeah, Sam Bolton.
Yeah, he's all these wicked sake. He's doing a great job.
Yeah, it's just a cool vibe. Obviously, you don't need us to tell you how good independent festival is.
No, obviously, it's just all the best people. Like, I ended up eating. I was a little full, but I was like, you know what? I'm having Meat Shack. Because they had the Korean burger on, which is, for my money, the best burger I've ever eaten. Their Korean burger is just insane. To the point where I think he's going to put it on. Like, it was a special, but I'm pretty sure he's going
to
put it on
permanently.
He's got
to put it on permanently.
It's the best burger I've ever eaten.
If not, I'm going to start a petition.
Although I've got to try the Christmas burger this year.
Yeah, the Christmas Shack comes every year because Laura nags him every year. Bite your brum, nags him every year.
Yeah.
He knows not to not pull it on because he'll be in trouble otherwise.
I find it mad that I haven't had it.
Oh, mate, gotta sort that out. Gotta sort that out. I find it funny. I was stuffed. I was like, no, I'm done. White flag in the air. I can't eat another thing. And then your wife came back with this milk cake from the milk cake man.
Oh,
I'd seen him about it. I know he's like opposite Paws in King's Eve. And I was like, what's that? Looks good, that does. Kinder Bueno milk cake.
It was a, what was she having? It wasn't Kinder Bueno. It was that biscuit everyone puts on fucking everything.
Oh, Biscoff. That was
it. Biscoff flavour. The biscuit that by itself is a bit rubbish, but you put it with other stuff and it becomes incredible.
Brilliant. Yeah, so I was like, give us a try. I had a little try. I was like, oh my, zoom.
Gone. Liam was straight up.
I was gone.
He's gone from, I'm full, I can't eat another thing, to, right, I'm going to get one of these.
Then I got an Oreo one. Oh, it's so good. I don't understand why it's that good.
Mate, I'm going up there today. King's Eve, I'm open. It's open. pick some stuff. Yeah, it was just a great day out there. You know what I mean? Good cocktails as well. Passing Fancies were there. Fox and Chance were there. Like, I obviously had a bit of both. Be rude not to when they're like that close to each other.
That's just a great day.
It really was.
We were at Nico the other night with everybody else. The whole of Birmingham.
The whole of Birmingham got invited, yeah. Six by Nico. Brand new place come to Birmingham. There's a few knocking around the country already. Really good idea, though. Six courses, £39.
Unbelievable. I don't know how they do it.
Changes every 6 weeks completely, not just like the odd course. The whole menu and can be completely different cuisine every 6 weeks.
Based around a theme as well. So we went for the chippy. Their take on the chippy tea.
Yeah.
But other places have had like the street food menu looked wicked.
Yeah, they've got some ones that look
really interesting. Catalonia, the one that was just...
Catalonia, yeah. They looked a good one. And you know what? Wine pairing, 5 glasses, £30. Hello.
Where are you getting 5 glasses for £30? Anywhere, nowhere.
I want to see if you can go in and just sit at the bar and just have the wine pairing. So you just get 5 wines.
It looked nice as well. It looks the part, the restaurant's stunning. Colmore Road, it's what you expect the restaurant to look like on Colmore.
Yeah,
Road,
they've done a good, it looks nice. Incredible value.
Yeah, it's a great introduction. You know, people are thinking, I wouldn't mind trying to taste the menu, but what happens if I pay like £400 for the two of us and then we don't like it? It's a good way for them to go, oh, no, what, we can go there, get these 6 courses each, have a try. Sorry, taste the menu, still not for me. Or they might think, you know, that was way better than I thought it would be. You can tell why people are into it now. Let's go and try 670 or somewhere.
That's what I mean. I think it's good for the city in the sense that it might push people into going to some more of the, like, even the lesser known, like Folium.
Yeah, it's like
a something like that. Right, I'll give it a go now. I really enjoyed that experience. Let's try like one of the OGs of Birmingham, see what's going on.
It's a great introduction to it, man.
Yeah. They've done a good job with that. It'll do well.
Cool. So on to today's episode. Another brilliant episode for you.
This one was a lot. I had so much fun on this one. So interesting.
I normally do all the talking, but because I love talking, but I feel like I let you go. You went for it. And I was like, Carl's enjoying himself here. I'm going to let him do all the talking.
I get on really well with Kay. Yeah. And she's really cool. I find her fascinating to talk to. Not that I don't find all our guests fascinating, but this Kay is just so interesting.
She's one of the nicest people ever.
She's really cool.
Today's episode, obviously, is with Kay Winwood from Gulp. She has a networking event. See you next Tuesday. I'm not sure if that runs every week or every fortnight.
It's worth checking out.
Yeah.
She's got loads. She's always doing interesting stuff, man. She goes into a lot of it on the podcast, but...
She's an artist who uses food as a medium. It's just the events that she does are so brilliant. We don't really get into the events. We talk around them, but don't go into any future ones.
Sometimes
we don't know when the podcast's going to come out, so we don't want to date it. But if you go onto her Instagram, her website, you'll see the list of events. If you can book onto one of them and just take in the whole experience for what it is, it's unlike anything else you will have ever tried.
Yeah, it's really different. It's really fun. It's just good crack. It really is. Everything she does is like interesting, which that's about like, it's interesting.
It's an interesting. It's unlike any episode we've ever done as well. Cool. So if you enjoy this episode, do us one massive favour. We love doing this episode. We bring it to you as often as we can for free. And in return, all we want from you is one thing. Go and tell one person. Have you heard Breaking Bread? It's this awesome podcast where they just champion Birmingham and talk about all the awesome food that's in Birmingham. Go and have a listen. If you could do that for us, it would make a massive difference and help us spread the positive Birmingham message. I hope you enjoy this episode with Kay Winwood. Thank you for inviting us up to Gulp.
You're welcome.
In the heart of the Jewellery Quarter. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Good.
Not too bad at all. It's a bit late for me, usually in bed, but yeah, it's okay.
I thought artists were meant to stay up all night, like taking like mind-bending drugs and doing mad
work.
Yeah,
I've done that. I've done that in my 30s. And now I'm a bit older that I have to be a bit more responsible. So now, I just drink wine quietly on the sofa, crawl up to bed.
That's mad. That's the opposite. I'm the opposite. I've hit 40 and I've just like, now I'm trying more drugs. I don't know why. I've just hit 40.
I don't want to.
It's like it's gone up a notch. I don't know why. Midlife crisis, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's 40 midlife. I don't know.
No, I think I'm more midlife.
Early life crisis.
Yeah, 40s are great, I think.
It's hard, isn't it? Because when you're young, now when you're a kid, you think 40 is ancient, like.
Yeah. Well, I read a lot. I read a lot of novels. They always talk about people being really old. Oh, my God, they were 40s. They were in their 40s or 50s. And I'm like, whoa. And I don't feel old, but I am quite old, but I don't feel it. I still feel 17 at college, having a pint of lager and black or something at the Mitre in Stourbridge. Yeah. Do you know, that's what, you know, that's my good times.
It's funny, I was watching that Santa Car, that's still game. I don't know if you watched it, the Scottish thing with the two old blokes.
No.
Like, how old are you this year? Oh, I'm 80 this year. How old do you feel? Still in my 30s. Yeah. I wonder if you do ever get to an age where you actually feel your age.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, when you wake up in the morning. Do you know, I think you can monitor it by your hangovers as well, or your aptitude for drinking.
Yeah, maybe,
I think that changes. Your appetite for drinking and getting shit-faced becomes harder because it's so much more difficult to recover. It's
a couple of days now, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I woke up from Saturday. I woke up today. Still hungover. From Saturday? Yeah. That's just from Whiskey Festival, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine that.
I was hungover all day yesterday and woke up today still pretty bad.
So how did you get to this point where we have Gulp? We'll get to, obviously, what Gulp is in a minute. How did you get to here? Okay.
So I trained as an artist, as a painter. Mm-hmm. Back in the 80s, late 80s. And then I worked with arts organisations, with Icon Gallery, with Vivid, and then did some freelance work, worked with festivals group, with Birmingham Contemporary Art Forum, with the Hippodrome, all different organisations. So I've got loads of experience in the arts, probably over 25 years. But something that ran through my interests in art as a kind of producer and curator were linked to conviviality and this notion of art not being about going and looking at a picture on the wall, but about experiencing it. So I was very interested in kind of art that didn't happen in a gallery, art that happens on a street, art that you'd encounter and experience in a different way. So it felt really natural to me to start working with food as an artistic medium. So I kind of took a bit of a sidestep and I started kind of curating with food. So curating events. So I showed the whole series of like Flux films when I worked at Vivid, and Fluxus is a movement in the 70s, and they worked with food quite a lot. And then I started working with a woman called Sean Tonkin, who you may know. She's a ceramicist in Birmingham, makes lots of ceramics for, she was making ceramics for Carter's. And we started a company called Companis, which means to break bread together. Funnily enough, talking to you guys. So com means with and pan is bread. So companionship is formed, this notion of people breaking bread together. And we did these kind of quite lewd food events for about 5 years we worked together.
When was this, sorry?
That was about 2010 to 15, okay, to be exact. About. And then in 2015, kind of went, I think, almost freelance, but almost exclusively, you know, without having too many contracts. I got a studio at Grand Union Complex, which is in Digbeth, which is part of Grand Union Gallery. And I started working with food by myself as a practitioner, started doing commissions with people like the museum at in Birmingham, the University of Birmingham. I became an honorary research associate, looking at kind of relational aspects of food, so how we relate to food, people relate to food and use it as an art practice. And for me, it was really interesting to use art, food as art, because essentially we all have to eat. We've all got this vernacular around food and eating, and we all have kind of sensory experiences of that. Even though we kind of maybe don't recognise them or we neglect them, we still have them. And essentially, we eat and then we shit it all out. And it's like this, what a better way to experience art than actually consuming it, rather than just consuming it with our eyes and ears, actually to consume it physically and have it as this kind of bodily experience. So I was at Grand Union Studios, and then we had lockdown, but before lockdown I had pneumonia for 6 months.
Wow.
Oh, 6 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
And all my contracts got cancelled because I'd been off for such a long time. And then I had the all clear from the doctors. I was actually working throughout as well. I was working with the University of, what's it called, BCU, on one of their co-lab projects at the time. And we were doing this synesthetic kind of futurist dining experience. And it was about to launch in March. It was just this like catalogue of catastrophe. So I had pneumonia from like September to March. And then they said, the doctor said, okay, are you ready to go back to work? I said, I really want to go back to work. So he signed me. He said, okay, then you know, stop the sick notes and everything. And then the following week, we went into lockdown. So I kind of had no income for quite a long time because of that. I was reliant on statutory sick pay that they made me go and sign for, even though I could barely walk. Do you know, it was like, it was awful. And then we went into lockdown and I just thought, well, I've got no income. I've got no contracts. They've all finished. I know what I'll do. I'll start a new thing. And like, I'd always wanted to have a space that was artistically driven. So the crockery, the tableware, the lighting, the sound was all developed by artists. And it became this huge artistic experience. And I happened upon this space. And I don't know if you've seen through the back, but I've got like quite a large studio. I've built a kitchen and then I've got this room as well, which is where we sit in Angorp. And together, they work together so that I can research and develop food and sensory materials as an artistic practice. So I just invested all my savings in moving here, really. And yeah, so I launched in, well, I moved here like in June 21. And then my first public event was the November, once I'd kind of decorated and everything. It was the November of that year. Ta-da!
Big risk. It's a massive risk to take. Have you always believed that food was art?
Yeah, always. Yeah. Well, I think if you look back at kind of like work from the, 15th century or something, like food is always depicted, whether it's as like often as symbology, like or symbols of religion or sin or pleasure. It's often been depicted in art. And then I think towards the kind of beginning of the 20th century, then it was used in art as a form of more engaged practice. So more like the physical or the physicality of the dining space, I think, was explored a bit more then, which is where my interests are. I could talk about it all day, but you probably don't want me to give a lecture.
That's exactly what we want to hear. We want to hear all about it.
Were you already good at the food side? Because it's all right making food look good, obviously flavour does play a massive part of it. Were you already quite talented or class yourself as quite a good cook before?
Not really. Sounds good. Yes, I know. No, I'm really good. I just think, I don't know, I've got a really heightened sense of taste and of smell in particular. Like I can smell anything. So I've got this thing where like I can imagine what things might taste like together, like what odd combinations might work. And for me, it's also not just about flavour profile, but like, you know, that horrible term that everyone hates, but mouthfeel. But like when you have like things in your mouth that kind of are more viscous or crunchy and playing with those kind of sensory aspects. So I'm interested in how food behaves in the mouth and feels as a material as opposed to just purely on taste.
I tend to find that's something that really, especially over Asia, they're quite hot on the different flavours and the different sensations in your mouth. Not so much over here, but they've got the crunchy, the smooth. It's all intertwined over just into the culture of how they eat there.
Because when you have something like, I don't know, say the texture of blancmange and it is just that texture, it kind of gets boring, doesn't it? Yeah. So you need other things to go with it, don't you? And I think I kind of play with that, but also play with maybe a little bit of the unexpected. So things that might burst in the mouth or things that you think might be sweet but a savoury, you know, that kind of subversion of food etiquette and food rules is like quite fun, isn't it? Rather than just giving somebody a plate of something that they know what it is, they know what it's going to taste like, and everybody else, you know, like loads of restaurants, it's like on point at that time. So I do the opposite.
Was it surprising to see how much like smell had an effect on the taste of food? Because have you seen the work from Charles Spence?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know, he'd done a lot of experiments. I don't know if he'd done them, but he obviously looked at the experiments where people had blind tastings or had to have a peg over their nose so they couldn't smell the
food. I was going to do that with you today, and I've been hunting for some jelly beans in the cupboard, but I couldn't find any.
It's surprising results, isn't it?
It's amazing. Yeah, it's something I use quite a lot. I do this thing called Scentsperiment, and it's like a big pack with different edibles and smells in. And like I work with people to go through each thing and try and guess what the smell is. But I use that. And I've got another little thing here for you to try as well if you wanted to, based on sound and taste. Because smell is really important to me. And there's, I've met Charles actually at his house in Oxford. But he runs the Crossmodal Lab at Oxford University, and he's written that book, Gastrophysics, and before that, Perfect Meal, which I actually prefer to Gastrophysics.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I just happen to have it here. That's funny.
I was trying to read it upside down. Oh, I was like,
it's really good because it's more, like, it's more illustrated. Mm-hmm. It's not as science-heavy, I think. It's really playful, the Perfect Meal, and it's with a guy called Joseph Youssef. That, like, smell is really important because it's that orthonasal and retronasal sensations. Do you know about that? Like so orthonasal is when you directly smell up your nose, like you sniff it up. But then the retronasal is as you chew food, the volatile molecules of smell get released and they hit the back of the nose. Wow. So that's why you have this combination or what's the word? Like fusion of taste and smell together and the way they impact. And that's why in COVID, when people lost their sense of smell, they also lost their sense of taste because they were so...
I lost mine for 2 weeks.
Did you?
It was horrible. It was like, you know, you think, oh, you'd be all right. You'll be all right for a couple of weeks. It's not a problem. I hated it.
Yeah.
Absolutely drove me absolutely
what
mad.
What did you do to like
I used to just
to
get really strong smelling stuff every day and try like Vicks was one. I was always trying to smell Vicks.
And you couldn't even smell
stuff
Vicks.
I knew like Vicks or Sudocrim for some reason. That's got a really... strong smell. I don't know why, but it's just a familiar one. I think that was the first thing I smelt because I'd just line them up and every day I'd try smelling them all.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get any smell off anything. But you can't taste anything. I mean, nothing. You just get texture in your mouth.
I can't imagine that. I'd be devastated. My mom, she had no sense of smell. And it's just like it affects your capacity to taste. So your enjoyment of food is diminished.
Yeah.
But I know somebody, isn't it called anosmia when you can't smell? And this person that I know, she can't smell or taste. She's a young woman. And so there are ways that you can, I suppose, compensate for that. Not fully, but like introducing like crunchy foods and introducing spice, because spice you feel on your palate. It's not a flavour, it's a sensation. So introducing sensations rather than actual tastes can contribute to you actually experiencing food even if you can't taste it. So she wrote this really interesting article about what to cook for Christmas dinner if you have anosmia. I think it's anosmia. I probably pronounced that wrong and it probably means something really different. Apologies. But but I find all of that really fascinating, how texture and all those kind of visual and sensory clues give to you before you put something in your mouth.
Yeah, it's mad. I think blindfolded, people can't tell. If it's cold, they can't tell the difference between white wine and red wine a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, Charles Spencer, and I think there's another scientist called Barry Smith, and they've done experimentations where they have white wine and put red food colouring in, and even the experts who try it, wine experts, think it's red wine.
Wow.
Because you mind over matter, isn't it?
It's crazy. It
tells the story of the steak dinner. In the dark room. So they have a dark room. They have a steak and chips, and everyone's eating it, saying, oh, this is brilliant, amazing. And then they switch the lights on, and, like, they've dye-coloured the chips are purple, the steak is green. People start getting physically sick.
Sick, yeah. Unbelievable that is, isn't it? Yeah.
And it's like they were proclaiming it to be the best steak they ever had. I don't know if it was cooked by Heston in that experiment.
It might have been, actually. Yeah. He's worked a lot with Heston. But, yeah, it's like... And it goes back, I suppose, to, I don't know, caveman, Neanderthal, when you, like, use your senses to find and gather food.
I suppose if you had something that was purple when you were a caveman. It could kill you.
Yeah, like blue and purple.
Green meat normally.
Blue and purple are just like colours that we kind of avoid eating, apart from kids who love, like, what is it, blue raspberry, Skittles.
I think it's overwhelmingly sugary. Anything overwhelmingly sugary in it overrides your natural fear of blue and purple.
WKD blue.
But I think, like, purple potatoes are slightly, you know, that for me is not appealing, really.
Yeah,
I don't know. Just get accustomed, black country, just get accustomed to, like, beige food, really. Anything with a colour is, like, unless it's cooked to death and pulp, you know, like, you know, when... my mum and dad always used to cook vegetables till, you know, you had to be able to put a knife right through them with ease. So they were like butter as opposed to like, they had no crunch left in them. They were just soggy.
Oh, yeah, you didn't need teeth for the vegetables.
No, just stuck them. Just had a straw. Didn't need cutlery.
My nan's roasting as they were. You didn't need teeth for most of it. Just the meat.
Yeah.
And especially the chicken. You'd need good teeth for the chicken as well.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny though, isn't it? Like those old-fashioned traits. Yeah.
I know you said about the 1930s, but how did that work? Because obviously then war came and food became obviously very scarce. Was that still happening most of the art projects around it? Or?
Well, a lot of it happened. Do you know, like, we have art movements. So one of the movements was the Futurists.
Yeah.
And so they used to use food a lot. So in 1930 or 32... In 1930, they wrote a cookbook called The Futurist Cookbook. I won't say it in Italian because it won't, with a black country accent, it doesn't sound so good. And then they opened a restaurant called The Holy Palette. So we did a project actually, I don't know if it was this year or last year, time just kind of goes by, called The Holy Palette, which was based on some of their recipes. But for me, politically, they were like really off kilter. They were fascists. They didn't really support women. They were interested, like, they tried to abolish pasta as part of their manifesto because they felt that virility was lessened by eating sluggish food. So what people should do is eat things like metal. So one of their recipes is like a chicken filled with ball bearings, like, which is inedible. And they were fantastical meals and, like, really kind of on the edge of what could and couldn't be eaten and what was palatable and not. But what was interesting about them, I think, is that they did these immersive dining experiences like you'd get now, like, but in the 1930s. So they did one called Tactile Dinner, and people, like waiters, wore suits with things on that you'd feel. Or you'd have like a cube and each side would have a different texture and you'd turn it over and feel it while you ate. Now, Charles Spence talks about this now because if you touch something while you're eating, it's smooth, and then you touch something that's rough and you're eating the same things, it brings out different flavours. So like rough textures tend to bring out saltiness and crunch. So you can actually affect what you're eating by doing that. And for them to have played with that in the 30s, I just think he's like mind-blowing. And they'd have like the sound of aeroplanes and air engines in the background as you were eating, and wine served from jerry cans. And it was all about looking to the future of industry, of aeronautics. So it played with that. But they also had like poets who would read poetry. They'd have perfume sprayed around the room as you... So it's this completely immersive scenario that I think has impacted modernist cuisine. And, like, so the cuisine that started in, like, the 90s and noughties, that, like, harks right back to that, but maybe doesn't kind of realise. I don't know if it doesn't realise or if it's just that it doesn't want to acknowledge that modernist food came perhaps from an artistic... scenario. I don't know, but to me it's like, I just love all that. It's batshit crazy. The menus are just like crazy, and I love it.
Yeah, I'm surprised they were so forward thinking in that aspect, how they were still fascist and still sexist and stuff like this. I know back in the 30s, like, the sexism wasn't an unusual thing then.
Yeah,
but you'd think they'd be more bohemian about their attitudes towards stuff if they're so interested in
Yeah, I suppose it's like right-wing fascism, like capitalism, like engendered their movement as opposed to like left avant-garde, maybe.
Probably heavily influenced by the church as well, if they were in Italy.
Probably
had a stronger hope. It kind of sounds like the Quakers, you know, the Quakers.
Yeah.
So like that's why cereal was invented, you know, like cornflakes.
Oh,
and yeah, because of the Quakers. It was like meant to be that boring. It was like mind-numbing. Wasn't meant to get you excited in the morning. Same as Weetabix.
It's crazy, isn't it, all of that?
Weetabix is shit as well. I don't know anybody. My daughter has Weetabix, and I try a bit every now and then, but it's still shit.
It do you know what? It's all right if you get the crunch softness right, but it's really hard to do. Leave it too long, and it's just like,
So we used to have it as kids. Hot, though. Hot milk.
Ooh.
When it was microwave, so it'd be milk on, then in the microwave.
Yeah.
And then back out, that's sprinkle posh, of sugar on, then back in the mic again. Ooh. So the sugar melted on the top.
Ooh, brûlée. Microwave brûlée.
I was just finding I used to just take the top layer off that had the sugar on and then drink the milk
leave
and
the
just
rest.
Sack the rest off.
Yeah.
My brother, though, used to put cornflakes. So we'd make the Weetabix like normal. And it was all mushy.
Yeah.
But then at the end, put some cornflakes to add crunch.
Oh, okay,
Some people have warm cornflakes, don't they?
Yeah. Do you know, I met someone once and they had orange juice on their cornflakes. I mean, that is just is just nasty.
That did make my stomach turn a little bit.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's horrible, isn't it?
I'm up for weird. I've got a big thing about cheese and onion crisps.
Mm-hmm.
Only Walkers, though.
Mm-hmm. They are different. They are superior.
But... Mm. With banana.
Oh, okay.
Cheese and onion crisp with banana, the combination of them two things. For me, I don't know what it is. It's only cheese and onion crisp. It's only that brand.
Together.
Yeah. It just
Do you make, have a crisp, put a slice of banana on, like a canape?
It's like one hand's got the crisp, one hand's got the banana.
Oh, and you go.
I don't do it anymore, but it was just something about being a kid. I was always.
Uh-huh.
You get a pack of crisps and banana after mass, basically, while you're waiting for your
Yeah.
And I'd just end up eating them both at the same time.
Was the banana in the mouth the same time as the crisps?
Yeah, a couple of crisps and then to bite the banana.
See, I think you're like self therapy. That is a banana crisps.
It was very odd, but I swear to God, it tasted good, honey. It definitely did.
Yeah. I was talking to somebody the other day about pickled onions. I love pickled onions. They're like. The ones that take the roof off your mouth, they actually peel the skin off. And I remember Christmas parties having a big plastic bowl of crisps and I'd just pour pickled onion vinegar on and eat those. It's like the Black Country sort of vinegar. Can't afford Walkers. So you have some pickled onion homemade crisps. Yeah. Or you get those little shaker bags. Remember the ones that you have little pouches of salt?
Your own salt
but in. You put your vinegar in and then you shake it until it's virtually drinkable crisps. Crunch with a sauce. It's like,
I think there's something there though.
I think there's still something going on there.
I think that's still a good idea.
Yeah, you can't beat pickled onion juice. Remember when you used to go to a chip in, you could have pickled onion juice on your chips.
When I get pickled onions, I save the juice. I use it on stuff.
Yeah.
I don't throw that away.
No, it's like nectar.
Yeah, it's way better on chips than normal vinegar,
isn't it? Yeah,
well, I've just got some
distilled or malt pickled onion juice.
It's what the baby ones come in.
Oh,
I like the baby ones.
Yeah,
it's like a couple in the mouth at the same time.
Yeah, they're a bit soft though. Oh, you need to get on the hard stuff now. You said you're trying all the different drugs. Need to get on the hard pickled onions, those big brown ones.
That's what I've got. I've got Pips ones now, the really hot ones.
Yes, so
I'm looking forward to. You know, I'm as excited about eating them as I am having the juice left over, the vinegar to use on your stuff.
Can't beat a big pickled onion. The smell of pickled onions is just divine.
It's mad. If you've never had one as well, people think there's probably people in other countries, you know, when you look at people eating fertilised duck eggs and stuff, you think, what are they doing there? It's probably people looking, I mean, you've pickled a fucking onion.
I went to the pub the other week and our local called the Midland, shout out to the Midland, and they have pickled eggs on the bar. Now, I can't do an egg, pickled egg. Eggs are my favourite food. I could talk to you about eggs for years as well. But we were there with our friends and the husband of my friend just went to the bar and he came back with an egg on a plate and just gave it to his wife. And she's like, what's that for? And he went, I bought you a pickled egg. He's actually very posh. So I bought you a pickled egg. And she was just like, I don't like pickled eggs. And he went, how do you know? And he made it, and It was really weird. It's like, just get some scratchings.
Yeah. I love it when you're in a pub and you can get black pudding on the bar. That's my favourite.
Oh, yeah. Black they pudding and white onion.
They still do that quite a lot.
Yeah. I like black pudding.
Yeah. Especially with a pint for some reason.
Oh, you like it? I'm really hungry.
I know. Yeah.
I don't know what it is about pickled eggs. I feel like it's the fact that you don't really know how long they've been there.
It's
in that.
Yeah, it's when you bite into it and you don't know if the yolk's going to be grey or not. That's my problem.
But then we've eaten century eggs and they're like, that's, I mean, that's fucked up. It's nice, but it's like you need something with it. But yeah, that's weird.
Yeah, I don't mind heavily fermented eggs, but like. Yeah. Pickled eggs. I don't know why.
I'll just take my chances. Yeah. It's fine. It's all right.
It's just them all bobbing around in that big vat on the bar or wherever, or in the chippy, and it's just like. Oh.
I think it's more that it's just warm the whole time as well.
Yeah. I mean, why don't they batter them? Batter eggs and like deep fry them. That'd be better, wouldn't it?
But I wouldn't like a pickled onion from the chippy either, because I think I've got something about. People putting their hands in the jar. No, I like having my own jar.
I have a little spoon.
Yeah, most of the time, until it gets busy. And then
I mean, if I was in the chip shop and someone just banged his hand in the jar and pulled out people, then there you go. I don't think I'd eat it then. No, I don't think I'd eat that.
I really want some chips, mushy peas and pickled onions. Yeah. I love a cob as well. That's my favorite.
Yeah. Gotta have a cob on the bar.
Oh, my favourite pub does cheese and onion cobs on a Saturday and a Sunday.
That thick cheese with the same thickness of onion.
I want the bread, the cheese and the onion all the same thickness. Yeah. Just like...
And the butter. I like the butter the same thickness as my cheese as well.
I'm bad as well with that. I squeeze it as hard as I can. So it's as flat as possible. Mm. My wife sits there going, please don't. Please don't.
There's nothing. Do you know what I had for lunch today?
Go on.
Because I've got a really... I've got a very... good sense of taste. Had a corned beef and brown sauce sandwich.
That's nice, though. That's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous.
Something about old-fashioned corned beef.
Yeah. There is, isn't there?
One of my meals as a kid, Liam knows what this is. My mum can cook, but sometimes she just didn't. One of our meals was smash. We've chopped up corned beef in it.
In cubes out the tin.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Just with that.
Did you have peas?
No, just that and red sauce. And then mix it all up so it all went pink.
Oh, no, see, I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's not very good. It's not a happy memory of food.
My partner apparently used to have mashed potato and they'd make a well. He's going to kill me for saying, make a well in the middle and then have oxtail soup poured in it and have soup and mash.
Wow.
And I always said it's a bit like, do you know that film, Closing... when he builds a thing with a mash. And I always say things like that.
You go to most pubs in Ireland, they'll have soup and mash on the menu.
What's soup and mash? Like smash? No.
No, it's just mashed potato with... It would be like two scoops of mash inside a bowl of soup.
Oh, sorry. I thought you meant like... No. I don't know what. I thought you meant super mash.
Super mash.
I thought it was like a superhero, like super mash.
Superhero mash.
To be fair, you get all different types. Remember we went for that... When you were stag doing, we were in Ireland, I think it was. And we went for... Your brother said he'd taken us to a steakhouse that didn't sell steak.
Yeah.
We had fish and chips with three different types of potato.
Yeah, that's quite common over there. That
chips, mashed potato and roast potato. Like,
All on one plate. Yeah, I can get that.
They do it differently. They come around and just offer you want some more potato. Yeah, all right.
I like a potato in any form, really. So that I'd go for that as well. As long as it's got some, like, maybe either loads of butter on it or gravy. I love gravy.
I'm bad for salt. If I could just get a boiled potato and just dip it in salt and just eat it.
In Canarian potatoes, they boil them in seawater, don't they? And they're like a salty outer layer.
That's what, when I was a kid, that's how my mum would cook potato spuds. They were just in loads of salty water in their skins. And then put on the table in their skins. And you just grabbed the whole thing, peeled it, loads of salt, bit of butter, that was it. Not mashed or anything.
Sounds great.
Yeah, that's how they
were. That's how food should be. Like flowery potatoes,
To be like that. I don't really know how we got to this.
No, nostalgia in food. But I think it's the bloody futurists. Took us backwards instead of forwards.
Fucking fascists.
So... How would you describe Gulp to somebody who's never been?
So it's a small kind of artistic-led space, 10-seater, quite nice, opulent, cosy, and the kind of values behind it are like to present extraordinary dinners that people might not be able to get anywhere else, often with a creative slant. So those are the kind of events we do. I also do like workshops and supper clubs and pop-ups and hires. So it's quite versatile, really. So I look at it as like almost like how an artist with a studio and artists using more traditional materials would have a gallery to show their work. I think the dining room is the space that I showcase my work. But then to make revenue, then I do more hires. So the chefs hire the space and like corporates hire the space for like meetings, senior management teams and things like that. And then they can have hospitality that's just that little bit different.
Bespoke to them and what
bespoke,
they're after.
Bespoke, yeah, yeah. Bespoke. So I do a lot of bespoke. Yeah, thank you for that.
It's just really a word at the moment. Yeah. It seems to be used on everything now.
Yeah, bespoke clothing, bespoke food. Yeah, so I often work with people. Recently, I did a dining experience for a group of 12. She wanted a Halloween-inspired Tarantino event. So I developed a menu that was all linked to Tarantino scenes and foods, from eyeballs. So I did some like eyeballs. I didn't do a sevadilla, no. I had loads of pills on the table. I made some pills with limoncello. Mm-hmm. So they were like, they popped in, they were like sherbet. So they were like really fizzy in the mouth. What else did I do? I did a kahuna burger. I did the Aldo's focaccia sandwich. I did the strudel with cigarette ash and cigarettes in the top.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. So, like, playing with that kind of as a theme, I suppose. And then I've done other things like somebody wanted, they had a 40th birthday party. They were from Tehran and they wanted something that kind of linked their journey from there to Birmingham. So it started off with a magic carpet, which was like a stenciled spice on with a herb, Persian herb frittata on a tile. And then went through all these lovely courses to this Eastern mess, which was a take on Eton mess, but with Eastern spices, but with Cadbury and Bird's chocolate. So it kind of, Bird's chocolate? Bird's custard. So it kind of took this journey through like time and space for them. So yeah, I do a lot of bespoke things as well. I've done a Mile High Club, as you do. So
how did that work? We're only about 30 metres off the ground.
There's a big staircase. So it was like, I met them at downstairs at the front door and then gave them a pill. There's a lot of pills going on in my work. So I met them downstairs, brought them up. They all had a boarding card in the post beforehand and the seat number and a reservation. And then I served things according to how they might have been served on an aeroplane. So like airplane food, but really nice. And then there was a soundtrack that accompanied it as well. And then, and then we landed and I chucked them out.
You know,
it wasn't quite as harsh as that, but
I've never eaten anything nice on a plane, not once. Maybe a pack of nuts, that's about it.
Then days are kind of gone. Remember years ago, you had something to eat on every plane though, didn't you?
Yeah.
Whereas now it's the first thing you get rid of. You're like, cut costs. No, I don't want that.
I've got a KLM flight and they came around handing pretzels out to people. I thought I was going mad.
Do you remember those savoury cheese things and they were all shaped like the car, like diamonds? And
Yeah.
I used to like those on the planes. I remember, you guys won't because you're too young, but I remember having a fag on a plane because you used to be able to smoke.
Oh, no, I remember smoking on a plane. Not me personally smoking on a plane, I'm that old.
Because you were three.
I remember just that curtain used to go across.
Yeah, I was behind that curtain.
It's like, how does that curtain stop anything?
Yeah. Like, can't believe it now that like you could smoke
that magic curtain could block all smoke.
Yeah. Like you'd walk through the curtain and it was just like fog.
Stars in your eyes. Yeah, you come out of it. I do remember that because my parents were obsessed with going on holiday. Nowhere good, but just obsessed with going on holiday. So we were quite lucky. We got a lot of Spain holidays when we were little. So yeah, I remember smoking on a plane. It was so weird.
So did you have to be in the smoky bit with your parents?
No, my parents didn't smoke.
Oh, I mean, just,
you might as well be.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like even a good curtain. It's like just a thin curtain went across the middle of the plane.
Yeah.
It did nothing. Might as well not been there.
That's weird, that is, isn't it?
It is strange now when you think about it. Smoking on a plane. Yeah. It's nice.
It even feels weird to think about smoking in restaurants and pubs now.
Yeah.
I know, yeah.
It is horrible, though, when you're eating and somebody's smoking next to you. Because now sometimes when you go overseas, you get that and you're like, oh, God. There's nothing worse than a reform smoke. And I'm a reform smoker, you see. So I like, I can, and I, with my ultra sense of smell as well, if anybody's had a fag, I can smell them like 20 yards away. And it's just like, oh, come on. But I'd still smoke in my dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still dream about smoking.
Yeah, I think I'd, if it wasn't bad for you, I think I'd just smoke permanently.
I think it's a common thing once you give something up, because I dream all the time that I got drunk, really drunk. And I wake up and I feel terrible. I'm like, oh my God, I had a drink. And then for a minute, I'm like, oh no, I didn't. I just dreamt.
It's really funny when you dream, you're drunk, isn't it?
So strange. But I've got like another friend who used to smoke and he said the same thing. He says he'll wake up like feeling terrible. He's like, oh my God, I smoked the whole pack of 20 last night. And he's like, no, I didn't. It's just a drink. I'm okay.
That's hilarious.
Do you have a favourite event that you've had here?
I've had loads of really nice. I've done, I tell you what I really enjoyed. I did a project with Tom Hicks, who's a photographer, and Liz Berry, who's a poet. And we did like a response to the Jewellery Quarter. And I've done it since in Digbeth with Steam House as well. So it was like this three-part thing where we did a photo walk with Tom, who's a brilliant photographer. And then we came here and I'd done a sensory food response to what we'd seen. And then Liz did a poetry workshop. And it was all about kind of the layers of the Jewellery Quarter. So the walk that we went on wasn't a typical like gold jeweler's walk. It was like a bit behind the scenes. There's a car park down the road and there's just loads of needles and stuff. When you see tin foil that somebody's eaten their dinner but they've thrown tin foil and you can tell there's something still in there and wondering what it is. So I saw that and I collected all these photos of things that I saw and printed them off and they were all over the table in this kind of huge table cover. And then I made food. Like, so I made cheese sandwiches, but I'd cut out teeth marks in them, then wrap them in tin foil, and that was part of the food that they'd eat. It's gross. But I loved it. And I also did, I made some heroin.
Not Breaking Bad, so no, not real.
It was
heroin.
Breaking Bad. So there was like heroin. So on the photos that were printed out, so we're quite big, A3, and then they're all kind of like layered. I'd put like where there was a scene from the car park with the needles, there'd be like little tin foils and like spoons and like heroin and it like it's built up, but it was all completely edible. And I made a tea with forage nettles from the cemetery. And yeah, I really enjoyed that project, actually. And I think it was nice just working with other artists and other art forms. And I did a similar one in Digbeth, which was great because that was much more about, so different to here, and much more about like graffiti and stuff. So I graffitied, I made nettle and lemon cake and then put powder all over the top in different forms like matcha and orange rind powder and different flavours and built up this kind of graffiti cake. And then I had like bottles of, what did I do now? I did bottles of smoke. Because when you walk down the canal, there's always like plastic bottles floating down and there's always loads of cigarettes. So I kind of fused those two kind of concepts and made bottles of smoke. So as people opened it, they'd get like this sensory experience of nicotine. So I kind of like that response, like being able to respond to a landscape in some way just by kind of collecting images of or little narratives of what stories might have been there, who's left that, and I took pressings of walls. And do you know the old metal toilet in the Jewellery Quarter? Have you seen it? It's like
Victorian. Yeah, yeah.
So I took pressing of that. I took a cast and then made that in chocolate, and you know, so people could almost eat part of the landscape as well.
Where do you find your creativity comes from? Is it something that's always been there, or have you had to work and you just know these processes work for you, so you just follow them, or is it just all come naturally to you?
It's a good question, that is. I don't you know. I think I just get really inspired by things around me. I think it's quite difficult sometimes to make artwork if it's really forced. So it's quite intuitive, I think, for me. So I get influenced by things like there's a wall down the road on Spencer Street and it's got moss growing down where there's a drip. Mm. So I made an edible version of that, like what would moss taste like? And I made this like cracker with, what was it now? It was a miso tahini paste and then nori on top, which sounds odd, but it was like, it tasted like what a spongy moss wall would taste like. And then, and as I was talking about it to people, they were like, oh God, yeah, that's really what that would taste like. Do you know, and I just think I get inspired to just, I see things on the floor and I think, what would that taste like? Or what would that feel like in your mouth? Which is really odd, isn't it? But it's funny because this is a jewellery quarter, so it's full of gold. But there's someone who lives down here and they always throw out galaxy wrappers. So I started taking photographs of all the galaxy wrappers because it's gold, isn't it? Like you can tell it's galaxy, it's gold. And then I started making chocolate wrappers, like, so casting chocolate over scrunched up paper and then spraying it gold so it looked like a discarded piece of wrapper, but it was edible. Mm. So I just kind of pull things, I suppose.
Do they have to be of the time or do you save ideas to do in the future?
Sometimes they just stay with me. So the things, do you know, things like nestle in the back of your brain and you think, I'm going to do that someday, but I haven't quite got a reason to do it now. So then you save it and you nestle it. So like I worked on a project last year. I really don't know what day it is, to be honest, never mind what year it is. I'm really confused with day, especially since lockdown. But I did this brilliant project with an artist called Simon Pope and it was about a 17th century cider making process in Exeter. And there's a farm called Halstow Farm and it's existed since the 1670s in the same family and they only make natural cider. So they don't use the champagne method of making it sparkly. So it's got a mother in it. You know, it's like you have to drink it within a certain period or the mother just grows. I've got a bottle still at home and it's like 2 years old now. So that, like it's going to be something like alien when I open it. But I worked with him on a project and it was like all encompassing. It was about microbiomes and how everything's kind of linked together. So from the soil to the trees to the lichen, and he developed this wassail that kind of sang in homage to the soil and then to the lichen and then to, so I make things that are like, I made the plates pressed around the orchard, around the apple trees, and used those in an event. We cut down some of the dead, like there was a storm, so we had like some, the plates were made out of the trees. And it was all about that place at that time. And I've got something here, which is a bit odd. But so I made this, it's from the lichen on the apple trees in that orchard. It's lovely. It's been washed and picked and washed and picked and what, because it's like been there. But like lichen as a, like, you could try it if you want. You can dip your finger and you might want a bit of water with it. But it's like, I use that on top of food. Like, yeah, so I've used, I made.
There's some properties, isn't there? It's like supposed to be super good for you.
Yeah, well, it's like healthy, isn't it? Because it's on there. It is a bit bitty in your mouth, though. Sorry, like as you get about to speak. But it tastes and smells, it's like floral, like apple blossom, which I just found fascinating. So I made some, made some cultured butter and used that as a garnish for it. So like for me, it's about, I suppose, rethinking what we can use as food. And Simon did like a conversation with Dan Saladino. And I was talking, and I had to ask a question. Well, I didn't have to, but it was suggested that I did. Luckily, it was online, so I could type it, so I didn't have to speak. But I was asking about lichen, because it's really interesting, isn't it? Because we eat seaweed and don't think anything about it, but we don't really eat lichen. And it's abundant, and it's nutritious, and it could be a new form of food source, especially when the climate's changing and... And food, there's food shortages and, like, there's so much poverty. You know, it's like maybe it makes me think that we should be considering alternative ways of gathering and eating food that aren't just Aldi, you know, as a or processed foods. It could be about what's readily available that we aren't tapping into. And I don't think we eat lichen over here, but I think we used to years ago. It was like a food source that we would have eaten, but not now.
Yeah, I think I watched a documentary on it on Netflix or something. It was used ages ago. It's used in other countries heavily. And we don't touch it anymore for some reason.
No. I mean, you have to be careful. You don't want to pick the yellow one.
It's like mushrooms. You can go foraging for mushrooms. You can find some bad ones or you can find some good ones.
But I don't know where the ideas come from, really. Just somewhere.
Has it always been natural, though, from birth? Like, as a kid, were you exactly the same now?
No, I don't think so. Because I trained as a painter, but I was really shit. Like, I was awful. So I had to find a different way of expressing myself. And it just so happened that the first project I did with food was at Walsall Art Gallery. And it was just like, well, we've got to make a menu about this. And it just came really naturally to write a menu. It's like writing a proposal. Do you know? It's like, and I love writing menus. Like the wording is kind of not poetic, but I like a narrative that runs through a menu. So sometimes when I think of a menu, I don't think of it as a, well, as the food, but also as like a journey, like that you take and one course goes into the next course, but not just through like the tastes that we have, but through this kind of imagining. There was one I did called Once Bitten. I did it with an artist called Sarah Hamilton Baker, and it took this journey across an icy landscape. So it intimated that you were on this journey. So it started with the cocktail, had ice that you broke. It was like an icebreaker at the beginning of the meal, and that went into the cocktail, and the cocktail was a pine martini. And then you'd have things like edible snowball, you know, and it kind of had this like real narrative and took you on a journey. And I love that about food. I think it's so sensory, and often we just eat because it's nourishment or we're hungry. But when you stop and think of the sensory properties of it and how it feels in your mouth, as well as being sensory, it's sensual as well. And I think that underlies a lot of what I do with my work.
So is that how you work with, say, a menu that you'll do for someone? You'll sit down to write a menu and that's the first basis? Or do you think, well, I want to do this and I want to do this, and then you'll write the menu to suit that?
No, it's just the menu normally, actually. Because I if I'm doing a bespoke, we love a bit of bespoke. If I'm doing a bespoke menu, then I'll sit with them and talk. I'll have like almost like a consultation and say, what is it you want? What things don't you want? You know, and the don'ts are as important as the likes, aren't they? And then I write a draft of a menu and send it to them and say, how does this suit what you're thinking? And then take it from there.
So it's almost like a story.
Yeah, it's almost like crafting an experience for somebody and just making it completely unique and special for that person. So something that they wouldn't get anywhere else. So I did an event, right, for Ollie. Lovely Ollie. It was his birthday and he asked me to do a menu. So I did this one. So because it was called Gilding the Ollie rather than Gilding the Lily, all the menu had to do in some way with gold. So it took this kind of journey through gold and it ended up, it was quite rude. So one of the courses, there's a glass. Liam, I don't know if you can see it down there. There's a glass with finger holes in it. And it's a glass that I made with a, as part of the... is there a glass down there?
It's like a ball.
So I made those in collaboration with another artist called Nuala Clooney, and they've been used in events all over the world. Well, not all over the world, but they were at like Alexandre Gauthier, who's a 2 or 3 Michelin star chef. He bought 200. Well, he hired 100 for an exhibition he got with another artist at the Palais de Tokyo. So you put your fingers in. So like for me, it's like thinking about fingering and, you know, and things that maybe you wouldn't consider at a dining table. But I know that he'd love that kind of stuff. So the first course was let's get fingered or something, you know, ask like, and then it was like, and just like, I just like being playful, but everything that he said he really liked duck, so I made sure there was a duck course in. The dessert, it was like another gold dessert with loads of phasylis on, which obviously I called syphilis, you know, and like just playing with language and, yeah, metaphor. I do a confectionery workshop, like a dessert workshop with Manja Manja Matt O'Callaghan from Manja Manja. And he makes this amazing, like, it's a chocolate salami. So it's like this pun. It looks like a salami. It's strung like a salami. But it's chocolate with, like, biscuit and pistachios. And it's absolutely gorgeous. So I made Ollie this a chocolate salami and then two chocolate cups. And I'd made truffles that went under the cups and this sparkler that came out the end. So it just looked like this massive ejaculating cock. Your cock and balls, and then you smash the balls up to get to the truffles. So that one was like a really playful one. They're not always that lewd, though, you know.
You've got a specialist market.
But, like, you know, it's like adapting things. So I knew that he'd love that. Yeah. So it was like making sure that I got his sense of fun and over-the-topness, you know.
I think that gets a lot. People forget this part of food a lot as well. Fun.
Yeah.
You're going out to enjoy yourself, so you want to have some fun.
And I just find that a lot of dining rooms, especially like more kind of Michelin style, they're kind of very beige. You sit there, you're talked at by a waiter, and there's this kind of big introduction. And it just feels like you're being preached to a bit or spoken to. I don't want somebody to stand over me for 5 minutes telling me every ingredient that I just immediately forget. You know, I'd rather like taste it and be inquisitive and go, oh, what was that? Or, you know, but it feels very austere, some dining experiences, don't they? And it's like, it is like you're going to church or like you're part of a theatre. And you're scared, you know, I think, it's not my cup of tea, really.
I think the good places have cottoned on that they need. The good places in Birmingham especially, they are fun to go to.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of playful elements.
Yeah, definitely.
They are interesting.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I want it to be interesting as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you think with all of, like, so obviously we talk about Charles Spence, all the research and stuff that's already out there, you don't see them incorporating much of it into, like, a tasting experience or...
Yeah, generally, you mean?
Yeah, in general, yeah.
No, you don't. I'm working with Rob Woods at the minute, and we're developing a menu because I'm really interested in flavour perception, so all the kind of visual and sensory clues that make you taste something, as we were talking about earlier. And we've designed a menu that's just fabric. So it's like swatches, and then that is the menu. So you pick... orange latex or a more grey cotton and there's all these. What we've done is we've sat down with this fabric. We went down the to Fancy Silk store and we spent ages in there just going, oh, this is nice. Oh, look at what would this taste like? And I was going, oh, yeah. And then, you know, we'd walk around and like we've got really similar brains. So we'd go, oh, imagine that as a such and such. And so we've picked 7 fabrics and we've got them in this swatch and it's going to be a menu of drinks. So we sat down afterwards after we'd picked our fabrics and just went, what does that remind you of? And we'd go, oh, I mean, I don't know what I should say really because I don't want to ruin it for when we actually do it. But, you know, it's like, oh, well, the texture of that, it's like granular. So maybe some crushed ice and the colour of it really reminds me of seawater or of... lemons or you know, and that is really intense. It has to be like intense. That one is really dark, it's plummy or chocolatey. So we've used our kind of sensory perception of texture and sight to determine what these cocktails are going to be. So we've got this menu that we're working on at the moment. The guests will choose based on whether they want orange latex or pink shimmer. Do you know? And then so it's a new way of approaching how we select what we select. And so that, I think, taps into the whole Charles Spence sensory perception and taste perception. And I think it is used by some people, but maybe like Kitchen Theory in London, Joseph Youssef, who works there, he works with Charles Spence, so they work a lot together. You know, it's like projection and and colour and taste and subversion, and it's very much kind of in keeping with the kind of parameters of Charles's research.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you even have to be that far out. Just the simple stuff, like thinking of like the whole experience as opposed to just, it should be pretty common knowledge now to know that you don't, it's not just about the food, it's about the whole experience. People rarely go to a restaurant just for the food.
No.
It's for their birthday, it's for their anniversary, or, and maybe if a restaurant focused more on building experience around that.
Yeah.
For the guests might be a lot
better. Just the way things are served can be like quite performance-based, can't it? Like without it being theatricized, it can be just a small gesture can make so much difference. Mm-hmm. Often when I've done bigger events, I've worked with performers, and then, you know, and it's not for me about them acting, it's about them adopting a kind of mannerism, which I think that also leads into that, but also just like the colour of plateware and things can just change things so much.
The loudness of the music, the weight of the cutlery.
Exactly, all of that. Can fool people, into thinking that it's more expensive than it is.
Do you think like the best chefs are the more artistic creatives? I suppose it goes into what makes it good. Is it classically trained by the book perfection, or is it like, you know, exciting? And
well, I think it could be either of those, could be really exciting. So like the people I suppose I look up to, not as I've ever eaten there because I can't, but like Massimo Bottura, he's like a hero of mine. And I love a lot of the kind of conceptualized food plates he does. So for me, he's like a hero. But then I've heard or I've read that somebody went and thought it wasn't all that. And I was just like, how can they say that? But Dominique Crenn, and how she uses narrative in her plates of food is just absolutely exquisite. And Grant Achatz from Millennia. Yeah, yeah, so those are the kind of like foods, if I had the bank balance, that I'd like to seek out. But then there's like, what is it, Black Axe? What's it called? Black Axe. Yeah, Mangle.
It's called Black Axe.
But I'd really like to try there. And I think that's conceptually driven, but on a different level, isn't it? It's not like, it doesn't feel like it's classically trained, but it might be.
Well, the cook comes from St. John's, doesn't it? So it's got that same ethos of just using it, all the parts of the animal. And but that's a restaurant. It's not necessarily, it is quite plain. It's like St. John's, it would be a plain restaurant. It's just very basic, well, not basic, but very good, honest cooking.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes it can almost accidentally be artsy and great with food, just by it being good and how you just looks on a plate. I think some people, they're just doing it naturally without thinking about the art side of it.
Yeah. I think for me, the intention isn't like to fancy things up or to make them out of reach, you know, like so like up their own arse that it doesn't mean anything. Mm. They have to like be really authentic. And if it's authentic in like, in concept and in delivery, and it tastes how it should taste, and it evokes a sensory response, then that's it for me, really, I think. You know, it doesn't have to be exquisitely cooked. But I should also say that I don't always do the cooking. That's another thing. Don't be put off by the fact that I might be cooking for you. Do you know, so I work with chefs as well. So like with Dan Lee, who did his pop-up here.
Yeah, we came to that.
He was the dream. He's the dream chef to work with. He was just he's just such a nice guy. Yeah, so I often work with or collaborate with other chefs. And I also should say that not everything that I do is here. A lot of stuff I research here in the studio, but I do off-site. So I've just done a project with the Museum of Royal Worcester, which taps into food, but it's not all about food. It's about sensory material. So I work with a group of learning disabled adults over 8 months, and we did all different kinds of things. Like we made tactile plates in response to the collection. We made pickles. We ate together. We made a table cover. So it's like more about the paraphernalia of the dining experience, but linking it to kind of 18th century dining in a way, but not like ramming it down their faces. Like, this is like, we need to like be true to this 18th century. It was just taking cues from 18th century dining. Like, they'd use pickles, we use pickles. So it's like looking at 18th century recipes and seeing how we could develop them. And then they made pickles and took them home with them. And, do you know, it was a really nice project. And at the end of the project on Saturday, we launched a sensory trail. So there's objects that they've made with their hands in porcelain. Because at the Museum of Royal Worcester, everything's behind glass, so you can't go and touch anything. You can touch the handling collection, but everything is so precious and it's worth so much money that for a group of people with learning disabilities, mobility issues, autism, it's quite off-putting to see everything behind glass and quite untenable. So one of the things that I wanted to do right from the outset is for them to be able to think what it might feel like to hold something in the collection. So we picked some objects and then bought some porcelain, and they made handheld objects that they squeezed in their hands that had the imprint of their hand, but it weighed the same as something in the collection, and it was made in porcelain and then just a simple glaze. And they're in the collection now. So they're like, there's six of them, I think, and people can hold the hand of the person who made it. And it's the weight of something in the collection, so you can get a sense of what it might feel like, but also what the hand of that person might feel like, because you can actually put your hand in their fingers. You know, it's like, it's lovely. So we did that. And then I also made a series of scented fans, so you could fan yourself to release the scent. And it was like a response to what things might have been, like what might have been served in that 18th century small mug, what perfume might have smelt like in Victorian days, you know. So I made loads of scents as well, and a sound tour. So there's all these different kind of sensory aspects. So it's not just food that I'm interested in, it's also how food comes together with taste, touch, smell, sound.
So that's currently on at Worcester now, so people can go visit that.
It is. It launched on Saturday, and then they open, I think it's, they've got winter hours, so I think it's Thursday to Sunday each week. And there's a lovely guide, like a map, so you can follow the trail around, which has got more detail. And as part of the launch event on Saturday, but this isn't like an ongoing thing, but I work with Annabelle Davies, who's a local chef. She works under the kind of moniker of Honey and Rye. And together we worked and developed a menu that related to periods in the history of the porcelain, but brought it up to date. So there's venison and pickled plums and on toast. And so we delivered all of that as well on Saturday. But that's not there to stay. That's commemorative. And I work with Matt quite a lot, you know, the Midlands Arts Centre.
Yeah.
So I did their 60th commemorative dinner last year. And had a compare, Tap Vision, compared it for me, which was hilarious. Fun. Yeah. So I created a menu that went through six decades. So it looked at kind of what was fashionable in each of those decades, but also it related to the context of the Mac and how it had grown from a school, a centre for children. And it was like a puppet theatre, and then how it's grown through the decades to be kind of more of a global kind of art form position.
You just got me at puppet school now. I'm just like...
Yeah, they did loads of puppets. And I was in the archive by myself. It was quite terrifying. But the puppets, actually, I did bring this in somewhere.
Oh, there's not a room just full of puppets.
No, but there are puppets. Say, and you walk in and... maybe I haven't got it. And
couldn't do it.
Yeah, I have got it, I think. Oh, that's it. So that's the taste of Mac. So that's what I did. Just because I can't remember everything, you see.
Cool. I've loved this, and we've got loads of good stuff. Is there anything in particular you want to talk about before we start wrapping things up?
Shall I tell you about See You Next Tuesday?
You have anything to tell us about?
shall I tell you about See You Next Tuesday?
Yeah, go on. Oh, I'm off. Don't worry about it.
So See You Next Tuesday. One of the things that I think is important but quite lacking in Birmingham, but it's a safe space for women to co-work. Mm-hmm. So I started to use Gulp on a Tuesday and sometimes on a Monday, but I won't say what that's called. So on a Tuesday, I have women who come to work between 9:30 and 5:30. I do a few biscuits, free teas, coffees, and like Wi-Fi. And it's a way of bringing women together who might work creatively, but not necessarily in the arts. Mm. So creatively, like just have a creative outlook on life more so. And every month I do a special event. So I do a See You Next Tuesday evening of networking, and I do really lovely food, not a meal, but not quite. It was supposed to be snacks, but it ended up really a small plate. So I'm going with small plates now. So I do small plates, a welcome drink, and people come and just, there's no real agenda. It's not like, do you know, when you go to a network meeting and they go, oh, no, who are you? Can you introduce yourself? Yeah. I don't really do that. Although it's quite nice for people. I do encourage people to say, oh, I go, oh, this is such and such. But they're just really nice, and we sit down and we chat and we eat lovely food. And I've got one in Christmas, at Christmas coming up, the Clitmas Spectacular, which which will be even more food and probably quite boozy, I'm hoping. Yeah. But I think it's, Gulp is about making things accessible to people or offering something that other people don't. So we also do a queer supper club called Swallow. That's my idea. every month we invite a different artist to make the menu for us. So the first one was by Maz Niall, who's A Girth of Venus on Instagram. And recently we've worked with Luke Thrush, who's part of the window artists, who did the collaboration with Punks and Chancers. So we work with like a queer artist to make a commemorative menu, which are kind of collectible limited editions. And we always do like gay icon cocktails. So we've done Judy Garland, Kylie Minogue, and also we did a Lady Gaga golden shower. Yeah, it's a specialism that we have here. So yeah, so we try and make sure that people who maybe sit on the perimeters are included as well.
Mm. For the See You Next Tuesday, do people have to get in touch and book in, or?
Yeah, the co-working, it's just email me or direct message me on Instagram, and then the events are on Eventbrite. Okay. All of my other events are on Yup. But Yup wouldn't market See You Next Tuesday because it had lewd connotations. So I had to put that one on Eventbrite. Do you know why I use the term See You Next Tuesday? Because my mum, this sounds really bad, I've got to be really careful how I say this, but my mum passed away earlier this year. And years ago, I did a project called the Rude Food Fiesta, where you walk through a giant mouth and came out of an arsehole into the festival. Genius. And that was with Sian Tonkin. I did that. I'd commissioned, do you know Annabelle? She made some cat, and I'd asked her to make these really beautiful cakes, but with like the horror, like rudest vulgar words she could think of. So there was a cake with gusher on, there was a cake with cunt on, there was a cake with like motherfucker on. And like we were selling these little mini cakes, and I posted something on social media, and my mom went, I can't believe you, if you see you next Tuesday. And I went, what? And I didn't know what she meant. And I was like, what? And she went, see you next Tuesday. I said, what, are you going to see me next Tuesday? What's like, it just went on for ages. And then it just clicked. And I went, oh, that's genius, Mum. I'm going to have to use that. And obviously it's something that everyone used, but I never heard of it before. So, and I thought, when she passed away this year, I thought, I'm going to res. I always knew that I was going to do something. We see you next Tuesday, you see. Yeah. And that was that little spark at the back. And then she passed away, and I said, I'm going to do a See You Next Tuesday Women's Network. And I, you know, and I'm sure my mum would like not be that appreciative, but it's kind of an homage to me mum.
Yeah, that's nice.
In a nice way. I'm not, it sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? Named after. No. You know, yeah.
Cool. So we finish off by Carl doing his little questions. They're just lighthearted, nothing about what we've been talking about, just
first just get a flavour of stuff that you like. And
just a fun way to
God, I'm not going to remember anything, though, you know that.
What's your favourite TV show?
Oh, I tell you what I do like, actually. I like The Bear.
that's good.
I'm enjoying that a lot. But we keep stopping and starting, and I really just want to get in it. And
I've watched the first, I haven't watched the second series yet. I'm saving it. I don't like to have more than one show on at the same time.
Oh.
So I tend to do one and then move on to another one.
How far have you gotten in Bear?
I've got to where they're just about to open the restaurant.
Have you seen the one where...
Don't tell me, I haven't watched it yet.
This won't spoil it. Have you seen the one where it goes to the like really high-end Michelin star restaurant?
Yeah.
And was it the hot dog? No, it wasn't the hot dog. It was the pizza. Was it the pizza? Chicago, that was it. So he was sent to Chicago to that high-end Michelin star restaurant.
Yeah, and he was training in the kitchen. There was just the two of them. Yeah.
But, you know, the customers were saying that they'd had a great experience in Chicago, but they were disappointed.
Yes.
Do you know that was based on a real thing that actually happened?
Oh, really?
Yeah, so at 11 Madison Park, you know, 11 Madison. Will, I can't remember his surname, he just brought out that Unreasonable Hospitality, that book, fantastic book. And he'd overheard some couple saying, we've had the best time in New York. We've met everywhere apart from we didn't get just a normal hot dog from one of the stands. So we like ran down to the nearest like hot dog cart, got the hot dog, gave it to the chef, said, give me a little swish of mustard, plate this like it's one of our own dishes. And then went over to Tab and said, we hear you've had the best time in New York, but didn't get to try the hot dog. Everyone needs to try the hot dog. And then presented it as like a table, like Michelin stars, wicked.
Yeah.
I hate episodes like that as well because it makes me want to work in kitchens again.
Yeah.
Although I remember how much I hated it, but then it inspires you to want to work in kitchens.
Do you know what amazed me about that particular episode? I'm not going to give anything away, but it was like, how much knowledge you accumulated in a week? I was thinking, yeah, right. It's like, and the other guy who did the desserts in Norway.
Yeah, he went to Copenhagen. Yeah, that was cool.
Oh, yeah, Denmark, sorry. Yeah. And it was just like, yeah, right. And he went into Noma, picked the things, and I was thinking, I'm sure you're not allowed to do that.
No. What's your favourite movie?
Tampopo.
What's this?
It's the best film with food, in my humble opinion. Well, one of the best. I have like a little list, but it's like a Japanese spaghetti western, and it's got all these narratives running through. Sex, there's lots of sex. It's fabulous. There's an amazing scene with an egg yolk.
Tampopo.
And I use egg yolks a lot in my work. Yeah, Tampopo. I've got it in DVD in the studio. I bought 3 copies because I was so worried about losing them, but you can stream it. And I'm hoping... I'm going to say this out to the gods now because I keep saying it, and I did touch Sam Bolton about it as well, but I really want to do an immersive dining experience around Tampopo. And I've even written a menu like years ago, but I've never done it. And it's my 2024 thing that I'm going to try and do somewhere with a nice big venue, if anybody's listening. It's just amazing. It's about this woman called Tampopo, like, which means dandelion.
Yeah.
And she... She sets up a noodle parlour, and it's about her like setting up the best noodle parlour, but then there's all these other things going on at the same time. It's probably 80s, I'd say.
I thought you were on about like really old.
Oh, no, it's not that old, no.
I watched some really famous film that's really, really old. I'm sure it's a Japanese story or something like this. I can't remember what the name of it is now. Oh, it's impossible to watch. I don't know how anyone watches it. It's like a really old-fashioned Japanese film that people rave about, and I just could not get my head around it at all.
Sometimes I get that with books. People go, you've got to read that, Wolf Hall. Like, there's a lot of books that I get 40 pages in, and then I just have to. But this year, I'm on my 30th or 31st book. I'm counting how many books I'm reading.
Wow, yeah.
Well, I've tried to do it because when my mum was really ill earlier this year, it was like just something that I used as a kind of relief, you know, just to absorb myself in something else. So I read a lot of fiction.
Do you have a favourite book?
Yeah, well, I've read one this year, and it's surprisingly, it's not really food related because I read a lot of Japanese and Korean food related books. I don't know, they write a lot about food. But I read Still Life by Sarah Winman. And it was at a time that was really dark. My mum was just about to die. And I just needed something really hopeful. And a couple of people suggested it's the most joyful book about relationships and love. And there is a lot of food actually in it, but I really enjoyed that.
Can you recommend a really good Korean or Japanese book about food?
Yeah, there's loads. There's convenience store.
Did they make a Netflix program about that?
No, you're thinking of Kim's Convenience Store, aren't you?
Is that what it is?
Yeah, because I started to watch that the other day. But yeah, I've got a whole little section. There's a really good, actually, Japanese book. I've got it next door if you want to borrow it. It's this trippy story. It's a book of stories. And the one story is like this trippy story of Japanese in China. And they find this kind of underground bar and this guy's really desperate to go in. But then it's like, it kind of mixes reality and fiction. So it's like, I think he's obviously had some heroin opiate experience. And the scene at the end where he's in the dark and this woman approaches him and her tongue's in his mouth, but then it becomes like he's swallowing her tongue and like it's all this trippy, but it is like exquisitely sexual and that's fabulous. I can't remember what it's called though, but I might dig that out in a bit.
Yeah, just tell us.
Do you have a favourite dish that you cook at home?
Oh, do you know what we like a lot at the minute? Really simple. Lamb kofta with yogurt flatbreads, maybe a bit of pickled red cabbage, yogurt, simple. Flatbread on the bottom, pile it up on the top. I love that. Yeah, I like kind of Turkish, Lebanese, middle, you know, all that kind of, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, pomegranates, pomegranate molasses, harissa, shove it all on, I say. Yeah, maybe even some like tiny little oven roasted potatoes as well, because we like a potato.
Do you get takeaway much?
Yeah.
What do you get?
Indian, Chinese. We've got a la Mexicana by us, Bearwoods.
Oh, you're so lucky.
But we don't often have that for takeaway. Well, we don't go that often, but I tell you what, we went the other week as a little treat and I had the margarita. Then I had to have a second one. It's just so good. And I wasn't expecting them to be so good.
Mm. I think about everything there. I'd be like, yeah. Oh, yeah, it'd be fine. And then I have it and I'm like, that's the best version of that.
Yeah.
Everything I've had there is the best version.
Yeah. I feel very lucky. Yeah, I was going to say other things. But yeah, I feel very lucky to have Jose and Patricia in Bearwood on the next road to me.
Do you have a favourite food destination in the world other than Birmingham?
I would like probably, with my daughter, probably like to go to Korea or Japan, Vietnam. I think. But then I'd also really like to go to Massimo Bottura's place or Dominique Crenn's place. I don't know, really. Maybe a global. Maybe I could do 18, what's it called, in a hot air balloon, just travel around.
Around the world in 80 days.
Yeah. And then
around the world in 80 restaurants.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you read Dominic's books?
Yeah. I've got one next door, actually. It's just beautiful. Yeah. And every time I work with a chef, I show them the photo of the forest floor plating.
Oh, unbelievable.
And that is the thing that I'd love, but when you know it's tempo recipe, I'm not going to do that, but like I imitate that quite a lot in when I do an event. Yeah, I just love like Chef's Table, I think it was, she's the one that awesome. I really remember. Yeah,
awesome.
Brilliant.
Oh, lovely.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you,
this has been really nice.
Oh, I've really enjoyed chatting to you.
Thanks, Kay.
Thank you.
Thank you.